I walked back out of the clinic, it felt like I was walking into Oz. Like I walked down into camp from Kansas into that clinic and then came back out. And it was like Oz. Everything was electrified. I mean, the sounds were brighter, a lot louder. The sky was bluer. The greens were greener. Everything was, the birds were chirping really loud. And much later on, I realized that was, you know, shock.
This is Tez Anderson. He's one of the more than a million Americans currently living with HIV. He was first diagnosed positive in 1986, and that was a time when, on average, an AIDS patient died within 15 months of diagnosis. Tez was only 26 years old when he received the news that made the world feel like Oz, buzzing with shock. Nearly 35 years later, Tez Anderson is still living, loving, and working. And today, the landscape of HIV is quite different. With the right medications, long-term treatments, and moderate lifestyle adjustments like nutrition and sleep regularity, people with HIV can expect to live just as long as their counterparts who are negative. New antiretroviral therapies, or ART, can make HIV viral load undetectable, meaning that someone who's HIV positive cannot pass the infection to others. And together with the effective use of PrEP medications for HIV-negative individuals, HIV is no longer a death sentence or a sentence to loneliness. But for those who survived the most brutal decades of the pandemic, there are costs to surviving. The loss of so many friends and loved ones, years spent preparing for death rather than building life, and the challenges of living to an age you never thought you'd reach. For this installment of our takeaway series, Aging While Queer, we spoke with Tez and began with the shock of his initial diagnosis.
Everyone was dying, and the fact was that 10 years later, I realized that I actually seroconverted and became HIV positive in 1983 because I was dating a guy that died from something mysterious. We didn't know what it was, and we lost touch because he lived out of town. And he was having something going on with his blood, and he sent me a letter saying, I'm going through some changes lately, to the tune of about 35 pounds less. And that was the last letter I ever got from him. And I remember that summer was when I had all the symptoms of seroconversion, but it took me a long time to put that together. I was diagnosed in 86. I've been living with the virus since 1983.
And so here you are, decades later, not gone. I'm wondering if the Oz effect is still in effect, maybe particularly in the moment of the pandemic crisis. I'm wondering about whether or not there was a renewed sense of shock and terror.
You know, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there was a little bit of echoes from the early days of the pandemic, of the HIV pandemic. I mean, it's funny, I was in Washington, D.C. this past week, and the bus would drive by ending the pandemic. And I'm like, which one? You know, because I've lived through two now. So at first there was shocks of the early days of AIDS because no one knew how it was transmitted and that sort of stuff. But that didn't last very long because they're very different viruses. And also because when HIV first arrived, no one noticed, no one gave a damn. And it was buried on the back page of the New York Times. And it was a very small news. With COVID, everybody was involved. It was much more infectious, of course. So there's similarities, but there's very big differences too. But at the beginning, yeah, I was like, oh my God, here we go again. Mm.
I actually turned in those early days to some of my friends and colleagues who are HIV positive to ask them specifically about, you know, how to think about and talk about what it meant to be in a contagious public health crisis. And I mean, given that literally some of the players on the national stage, like Fauci, were the same actual players, right? What we needed to be thinking about and looking for that maybe we missed in the 80s.
I mean, the thing was that there really is no group of people who know more about surviving a pandemic than HIV long-term survivors. I mean, there's 1.1 or 1.2 million people in the U.S. now living with HIV, and over half of them are over 50, quarter of them. 25% are long-term survivors like myself who were diagnosed at a time before there were effective medications. In fact, when I was diagnosed, there were no medications, and you know, people were dying. I think the kind of swimming upstream feeling that the people were getting during COVID, and the panic and the sheer confusion and terror that they were feeling, was something that we were familiar with and had navigated our way through, most of us. I mean, it's interesting how in the early days of the COVID pandemic, it brought up a lot of stuff from the early pandemic. But for me, when I first found out I was positive, I decided to be the best dying guy in the world. How about books on death and dying? And I plunged myself into the idea that I was going to die. And I lived that way for 20 years. I mean, I went back to the doctor after the first 2 years and he said, 2 more years. I was like, okay, well, readjust there. And we did that for a decade. And I finally said, you don't really have any idea what you're talking about, do you? And he said, well, not exactly. And I said, well, then stop telling people they're dying, because they make plans to die, not plans to live. And at some point, that very idea that dying, I can wrap my brain around, because it was logical. It was, we were put on Earth for one reason, to eventually die. What we do with that time is ours, but I'm just saying that we all gonna, it's all the same end point. And for me, I realized that I had to kind of, I don't know, step up to the plate and live as well as I could live. I was ill prepared for aging with HIV. As I started approaching 50, I went down a bad rabbit hole. It was about 5 years of a dark night of the soul. That's a pleasant way of putting a nervous breakdown. Because I was having all these things going on, I was, you know, scared and depressed and couldn't sleep and was having nightmares and was suicidal and was isolated and had very negative thoughts. And apparently I was very, 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 very angry and unpleasant. I didn't really know how much I was, but the idea that living with HIV was as big a upheaval as learning I was going to die was kind of what was the origins for AIDS survivor syndrome.
When you say that you were ill-prepared to age with HIV, walk me through that a little bit more. Certainly part of it is about losing others, being a survivor, but what was making you angry?
I blamed myself. I felt stupid for not having, I mean, for instance, dead guys don't need 401ks, whatever they are. I spent my life not planning. I didn't save for retirement because I wasn't supposed to retire. I wasn't going to live to see 30. And so there was ways in which I was like, you bought the lie. I was telling myself these things, but even the paradox of it is that those things were true, because I lost so many loved ones to AIDS. The thing that made me angriest, I think, was just that I was on the first trials for AZT, the first medication, and I was on the trials for the D drugs, which were short-lived but effective. But they started causing neuropathy, and neuropathy is a kind of a numbness and a pain in my feet and hands, especially my feet. But I wasn't as physically able. I mean, I always sort of say 60 is the new 80 when you had HIV for 38 years. You know, we're aging faster. So there was the loss, the sense of loss of self. I mean, ability to do things I wanted to do. And I used to love to take hikes, but I can't do that anymore. So there were so many things I'd given up. And also larger than that, I wasn't living fully. I thought I was living fully, but I wasn't, because I was living with this time bomb in my head. Like, it will all end. Every time somebody would die, I think, I'm next. And so you live that way for a while and you learn to live in the short term. So for me, the anger, I think, came from watching people taking aging for granted. Because, I mean, I know that aging is a privilege, and I know that so many of my friends and loved ones didn't have that privilege. I also know that aging, as Bette Davis says, is not for sissies. She was wrong, because I was a sissy, and and I'm doing it okay. But I mean, some days I just have to stay in bed all day. I also have lucky, because I have been able to form a community around the idea of long-term survivorship and finding other people. Because I thought the stuff that I was going through when I was talking about AIDS survivor syndrome, that was only me. I thought I was the only one going through that stuff. And once I started explaining it to other people, other survivors, people that I had lost touch with and started getting back in touch with, it was the same process I did when I was going to die. When I began to realize I was going to live, psychology had always been a kind of hobby of mine, books and reading. I'm a reader. And so I began looking into this idea of what's going on. You know, why am I having all these things? And I was seeing therapists who were very qualified people who were treating me for depression and anxiety and sleep disorder, but they didn't see the bigger picture. That it was about this kind of the torrents of surviving AIDS for so long and all those losses and the loss itself, the loss of the body, loss of sexy, you know, you're like, oh, where's that belly coming from? And I think as a queer person, as a gay man, you know, we put so much stock in the way we look that it took me some time to embrace the gray and accept the fact that I was going to be older. I'm happy with it now because I've got a good life. I don't make any money, but I got a good life otherwise. I have a husband and a dog and friends. And as I say, I'm doing work that means something to me. But I feel very lucky that I have all that and that AIDS taught me to take your situation and turn it into activism and turning it into purpose. I mean, I always thought that, you know, I used to watch Oprah and she was talking about find your purpose. And I kept looking. I'm looking. but it was never showed up. But my purpose found me in a very unexpected, very awful way. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But on the other side of it now, it was the most amazing gift ever.
So tell me, how do you kick ass? In other words, how do you and the others who you are working with and in community with, how do you push back against the AIDS survivor syndrome and find that joy in aging and in surviving despite the horror of the losses?
How do we kick ass? We kick ass by coming together and supporting each other and accepting that what we lived through and what we are dealing with now in the post-trauma, post-resilience age of it is a perfectly natural response to an extraordinary event. But, you know, we're dealing with ageism now, something we never expected to deal with. That thing of being so old you're invisible to the people again. And it's just, it feels like a bitter pill sometimes, but if you make enough noise, they notice you.
Tez Anderson, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. It's lovely to be with you.
Now, before we go, we want to leave you with the words of our own David Gable. He's a gay man living with HIV, and he is a vital member of the Takeaway team and actually of the entire WNYC team. He's a true inspiration to all of us.
It has gotten tremendously easier. The first decade or so was lots of unknowns, lots of medications, lots of changes, lots of running to the doctor. And truthfully, some of that stuff remains. I still go to the doctor a lot. I still take pills. I still have to be sure I have health insurance. But I am grateful that I am here. I am healthy. I have a non-detectable viral load, which means I can't pass it on to anyone. All of that's terrific. It still is something that people are surprised to hear. It certainly hasn't gone away. But there are a whole bunch of us who lived through it and are here to tell the tale.
And you're a part of this conversation too.
Hey, I'm calling about the question about living with HIV. My name is Daryl. I'm in East Texas, and I'm okay. I'm very grateful for how far science and medicine has come and the ability to live a manageable disease with a manageable illness today. And I don't know what you're asking, but it is possible to live a full life and I'm so grateful for that.
This is Derek from Vegas, and I'm thriving with HIV.
I don't let HIV get me down. It has opened me up to a whole new community of people who are dealing with the same issue, and it's sort of been life-saving that I have found a community of folks. So HIV ain't getting me.
Now, if you have anything you want to share with us, or you have show ideas, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. We always love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. Come on back for more tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.